Hey there, you're listening to Ghost Notes, the podcast where we talk about music inside and out. My name's Noah, and you probably know me best as Polyphonic.
And I'm Corey, and you probably know me as 12 Tone. And today, we're going to talk about standards, by which I mostly mean Noah's going to talk about standards, and I'm going to agree and chime in with some weird jokes. But yeah, do you want to get us started on this?
Yeah, well, you see, Corey, music used to have standards. That's my favorite dad joke.
Yeah, now it's all just personal expression.
Yes, yeah. Generally, like, when we talk about standards, what we talk about is a collection of songs that is sort of universally agreed upon as just songs that any professional musician knows how to play. You know, standards is a very loose term. Like, there's no governing body, but essentially it's a canon of songs that, you know, in theory, you can go into a room full of musicians and say, okay, everybody, you know, we're going to do My Funny Valentine in this key or whatever. And yeah, everyone in theory should be able to kind of pick it up. And it's not like everyone can like pick it up and play it perfectly first time through, but it's sort of an even footing in which all musicians can come to something knowing generally what the changes in melody of this song are.
And like, just to be a little more specific on one point, all musicians within a genre.
Yes.
Or within a scene. Yes. Like, this is, yeah, this, I suspect most people listening to this will be aware, but like, it's not, you shouldn't expect to be able to walk into a room full of professional like metal guitarists and be like, we're playing My Funny Valentine, and
yeah,
get anything but weird looks.
Yeah. That immediately kind of gets into one of my big sort of things with standards, and my big gripes is that they don't really exist in most scenes anymore. The place where they exist still, and where they, like, you know, just sort of were really, the concept of the standard was really, really sort of solidified in jazz. And there's sort of a number of reasons for that. Part of it is just the historical period when jazz happened. Part of it is also the nature of jazz, and especially bebop, is so improvisational that it's really nice to have a clear, even ground that people can improvise on. And it is what allows for open drop-in jam nights and stuff like that, is everyone, there's this sort of loose canon of songs that everyone knows. So if you show up to an after-hours jam night, someone starts doing the changes for one of these standards, and you know, you already know what chords to play in. And then, you know, when you're on that common ground, you suddenly, you can do more exciting stuff, and you can engage with the music in very different ways that, you know, you might not be able to if you need to spend a lot of time learning the song in the beginning.
And that, I think, speaks to what to me is a really important part of the difference between a standard and a classic, where like a lot of what makes a standard is interpretation.
Yes.
Right? Like, I suspect most rock guitarists, if you walked in and were like, hey, can we run Stairway to Heaven? They know how to play that. Like, yeah, that's pretty baked into that. But there's not this idea that you're going to show up at a gig, call Stairway to Heaven, and then do your own version.
Yeah.
Like, you might, if you're doing a cover.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think that gets very much into one of the things that I really like talking about with standards and with this is very much that idea that everyone can sort of put their own spin on it. It's something that, you know, I love this topic because it just hits all of my, you know, favorite sweet spots. We'll get to the Dylan stuff later because there is a very real Dylan aspect to this.
There's, yeah, definitely. I know where you're going with that.
Yeah. But the, like, just the way that it creates a communal ownership over these songs, right? When you're covering somebody, you are taking somebody else's song and sort of putting your own spin on it. But the whole idea is that you are engaging with another artist's work. With standards, you are engaging with a tune. You are engaging with something that is just generally known. And, you know, it's really, it it's really fun from the musician's standpoint, and it's really helpful from the musician's standpoint. But I also think from the listener's standpoint, like, it's a great way to get to know, you know, new artists is, okay, yeah, you know, I know what Chet Baker's My Funny Valentine sounds like. What does Ella Fitzgerald's My Funny Valentine sound yeah like? What does Nina Simone's sound like? And, you know, you can, because you know this song and because you have this love for the song, it gives you an easy way to approach these new artists when they're working yeah in a mode that you already, that already means something to you.
Yeah. And I think one thing that many of our viewers might not recognize, but that we're sort of hitting on here, is that in terms of jazz standards, My Funny Valentine is the only one.
Yes. Yes.
There are no others.
Definitely not others. Yeah. There's definitely not Stormy yeah Weather or Stella by Starlight.
Yeah. If anyone tells you there's a book of them, it's fake.
Yes. Well, the book is fake. There is, that is, there is no book in the Great American Songbook. but I mean, I think something that's interesting too about the way that these operate is that these standards were not written to be standards, yeah, right? Like they were written, most of them were written for a purpose, whether that's, you know, a show or written with a specific artist in mind. I mean, sometimes they're written with a specific artist in mind and that artist doesn't even end up doing them. Like Stormy Weather was, yeah, was written with Cab Calloway in mind, but Ethel Waters ended up originating it. Do you call it originating with a standard?
Sure. Why not?
And I think that is something that I really, it still sometimes happens, but I wish it happened more, that songs got sort of elevated from being one artist's song to being a standard, you know? And I think yeah there, I think there are some songs around in the modern age that are standards. I think about this a lot, like Blitzkrieg Bop by the Ramones is the punk standard, right? Like
yeah
you can go to any punk bar in the world and ask somebody to play Blitzkrieg Bop and they'll be able to do it because it is I mean, A, it's incredibly simple, but also it's sort of the core of yeah punk rock and everyone knows it and it's fun to play and it's fun to sing and it's fun to dance.
It's so fun to sing. Like as yeah like I got to do it in college for a class and it's just like it was a blast. Because it's yeah just it's so easy, but it's so evocative. But this, yeah, we're not talking about Blitzkrieg Bop. Yeah. This is not the podcast thing. We don't have to, although if you wanted to, I don't want to cut you off there, but.
Yeah, no. Well, and I was going to say just actually bringing it back to standards, like that's something that is, that's so nice about standards as a construction is like I have seen Blitzkrieg Bop played in a punk bar in China where the Chinese band opening and the Canadian band that was headlining came on stage at the end to play Blitzkrieg Bop. And that's the sort of thing that you can have in a world yeah of standards that you don't get in a world of, you know, song ownership, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're definitely hitting that Ghost Notes classic of like cultural ownership of art.
Yes.
But I think that there is sort of a bit of a trade-off, like again, sort of going back to things that I talk about a lot, the work concept is, I think, a big question here. This is sort of the idea of a work of art as a single identifiable object, as opposed to, it's basically the idea that, you know, there is a single identifiable thing that is the work of art. This is often, you know, the song or the recorded song in yeah modern popular music, and that is something that you can do. And I think that there's an extent to which that runs up against the idea of a standard, because a lot of what a standard is a skeleton.
Yes.
Right? Like when we talk about My Funny Valentine, the only jazz standard that exists, we're not talking about like an instrumentation. We're not talking about a time feel. We're not talking about a tempo. We're not talking about even a key. Like there's all sorts of things we're not talking about. What we're talking about is a basic sense of the chord progression and then a basic sense of the melody. And yeah those are both still, you can play around with those. You can change those too, but that's, it is very much an extremely stripped down concept of what a song is. And if you just have those with nothing else, you don't actually have music. And so what makes it open to this sort of interpretation is that there's all of these gaps. Whereas if you look at something like, I don't know, like Enter Sandman, to pick an example, so much of Enter Sandman essential to being Enter Sandman in my mind. Like, I think if you don't have that riff played roughly the same way it was played, you know, you don't have the song. And if you don't have the melody or the structure, like, there's all of these things that you have to have in order for it to be that. And so there is a much more crystallized work in a way that you need to not really have in order to have a standard.
And I think that when you are, even when someone is, you know, covering Enter Sandman, whether it's like a postmodern jukebox or whatever, like, anyone doing a very different cover of Sandman, what they are still interacting with is Metallica's version of Sandman.
Yeah. It's all the choices Metallica made.
When somebody is doing Stormy Weather, what they are interacting with is, you know, Frank Sinatra's Stormy Weather, but also Ethel Waters' Stormy Weather, also Etta James's Stormy Weather, you know, or even more sort of out there when someone's doing like this is generally what bebop is so built around, is it is taking these standards that everyone knows and engages with and stretching them out into a weird, different place. I mean, if you want to see sort of, if you want me to talk about that process in depth, you should watch my video on My Favorite Things. Because My Favorite Things, when he recorded that, was kind of not, it wasn't really a standard. It was a new pop song, but it quickly became a standard. And I mean, that's another thing that I want to talk about in this, is the way that pop songs could become standards. I mentioned that a little earlier and got diverted. But anyways, like when you look at bebop, when you get or anything sort of like post-bop, to when you get like Miles Davis doing Stella by Starlight, what it's doing is it's tapping into this sort of collective unconsciousness of all of us who are jazz fans, who listen to Stella by Starlight, have an idea of what this song is. And then, you know, Miles Davis is kind of injecting his own version of that song into this collective unconscious and sort of, you know, saying, here's what I view as the pure emotion of this song, you know, or here's what this song is stretched and exploited to its limit, or something like that. And
here's my vision for this song.
And then what it's doing is then informing whoever does a version after that.
Yeah, there's that. And also, one thing that I think is really important about the tradition of standards is that, like, you may never have even heard the original.
Yes.
Like, after a certain point, a thing becomes a part of the cultural conversation. It becomes baked into these ideas, and you don't even, you know, there's, especially in jazz, there is a, like, cultural value on knowing the history, on going back and engaging with the tradition deeply and listening to these old recordings. But, you know, you may not go all the way back to the original, like, Broadway debut of some of these songs or whatever. Like, you don't need that in order to really engage.
A lot of these standards, you literally couldn't, because there is no recording of the, you know, original version. Like, some of these of these standards date back to the early days of recording, if not earlier. And, you know, especially in something like the blues, like blues standards. Yeah, there is no definitive version. You know, the versions that you're getting from early recordings of Sun House or someone like that is like even those are often still a step or two removed from things. And I mean, that's also just getting into folk music more, which I do want to say, like, there is a relationship to folk music. Standards are closer to folk music than pop music is, I think, you know, like modern pop, but I don't think standards are necessarily folk music just by virtue of having, you know, a shared world.
No. But I think you're hitting on a really important point that I was going to bring up a little bit later, which is, like, when we talk about how there are no, like, modern standards, or in sort of a lot of modern genres, there aren't standards. I think a lot of that has to do with the rise of recorded music.
Yes, 100%.
So much you can be so much, because again, a lot of a standard is stripping away the specific choices of an artist. But when you can just record this one song and have it be the definitive version of Stairway to Heaven, Enter Sandman, Friday, whatever song you want it to be, there is this stronger structure supporting the specific choices made by the artist. And there are additional choices you can make, right? Like when you're writing for Broadway in the early 20th century, you can't make decisions about the specific timbre of your synth.
Yeah.
Like that's not a choice you can make. And you can't make choices about how you want to process the vocals after they've been sung, because you can't do that. And so at that point, once you introduce the studio, you introduce all of these new ways of making music and of conceptualizing making music that are kind of not necessarily hostile to standardization, but certainly not conducive to standardization.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting, though, because I think I agree that they're not conducive, but I think a lot of the I think this is where we get to the Dylan portion, because really it's in the mid 60s that you really see the standards start to evaporate. And that is part of all of those things that you're talking about. And then the other aspect that plays really big into it is then the sort of shift of the marketing of musicians into singer-songwriters. And into more sort of confessional artists like that. That's something that it happened for a lot of reasons. The biggest reason it happened is Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan ruined music. That's I think what both of us are saying.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's what I always say. Yeah. And yeah, to be clear, because this is Ghost Notes, I really love singer-songwriter music, and I think that it should exist. I just think that, you know, it's a shame that it completely edged out the standard when I think there's a really neat period where, like, you look at one of my favorite singers for this is Nina Simone, because Nina Simone, who was contemporaneous with Dylan and the Beatles and stuff like that, like, did their songs as standards, essentially, like used a lot of the aesthetic language of standards, and then also, you know, would just like put them on an album next to a song written by Irving Berlin or something like that. And and a lot of the old sort of standard singers, like Frank Sinatra covered something, and like Ray Charles did something too.
Something the Beatles song, just to be clear for listeners.
Yes. That's
always confuses me when Ray Charles did something. But no, sorry. Continue.
It is this moment where standards were, you know, there was artists sort of trying to turn these pop things into standards, because there's a world where, like, you know, that is, in my mind at least, like, that's kind of as big a compliment as a song can get, is becoming a standard, because it just means that everybody, you know, everybody will live that song over and over again. But the other thing too is, like, as the music industry was rising, and as you had, like, you're talking about, like, the birth of the studio as instrument and stuff like this, there's less and less incentive for a song to become a standard when, you know, we put all this time and money and effort into this. We want everyone to think of Strawberry Fields Forever as a Beatles song and nothing else, you know?
Yeah. It also just becomes less the default mode of cultural transmission, where, again, prior to recorded music in like the 19th century, if you wanted someone to hear the song you wrote, you needed someone to play it. And if you wanted a bunch of people in a bunch of different places to hear the song you wrote, you wanted other people to be playing your song.
Yeah.
That was how your song got around the world. Whereas, especially once you have recorded stuff, it's not like this was an overnight switch, right? You say, we had recorded music for a long time before the 1960s, but it was really 60s through the 70s and especially into the 80s where like the studio as instrument really became a thing. And partly that's, you know, technology advancing to give studio production more options. It became easier and easier to do things in a studio that were not replicating a live environment, where if you look at like even recordings in the 50s, most of that is meant to sound like you are hearing the band in a live venue. And so it feels more natural to treat it the way you would treat something you experience in a live venue. Whereas you get to you get to the 80s and that just stops being the intent.
Well, and it starts with, again, the Beatles and the Beach Boys doing psychedelic soundscapes and tape experimentation. And yeah, it is really interesting. I completely agree with you that, you know, changes how you come to a song as a standard, because often, you know, even in even outside of jazz, there is a sort of naturalistic feel to songs that become standards. Yeah. Like Blitzkrieg Bop just feels like a punk band in a punk bar playing that song, right? And another one that
there's
I think
back masking or weird tape effects or anything.
Another sort of more modern song that I think has reached the point of standard in rock, and again, it has a relatively sort of naturalistic feel, is Seven Nation Army.
Yeah, I could see that. That's and again, this was, because I did a video on Seven Nation Army, and this was the thing I talked about in there, is that it's not true that entire song was Jack and Meg sitting down and playing the thing in one take with one microphone, but it sure feels like it's true.
Yes. Yeah.
If you told me that and I didn't know better, I would buy it.
Yeah. It is a lot harder for something to become a standard when, you know, one singer and an acoustic guitar can't sit down and be like, okay, so here's where the string cascade comes in. And here's where we back mask that cymbal hit. Oh, and let's throw a gate on my foot stomps.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of it definitely does come down to that ease of reproducibility. Like any jazz standard, pretty much, you can play solo on a piano.
Yeah.
That may not be the most common way, although people certainly do it, but that is an option. And so you can sort of build whatever ensemble you want on top of that. And that, I think, is a lot of it too, is that a lot of the value of a standard is it's a really useful thing to just throw to whoever happens to be there.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're doing, I don't know, My Immortal by Evanescence, it's just all right, who here brought their violin and who's going to cover that? And, you know, maybe the piano has their string patch, whatever. But you know, those sorts of things become much more, again, because there's so much more of a fixed work that says this is what this song is, it becomes much harder to just sort of throw it in with whoever you happen to have. Where there's no instrument that you need in order to play any particular jazz standard.
It is one of the frequent things that happens in jazz standards is that, again, especially in bebop, the arrangement will be thrown around to the different instrumentalists that will kind of get to show off what they do with this standard, with these changes, with this melody line. That's very much part of jazz.
Yeah, which also brings up another point, which is that, you know, in the performance of a jazz standard, so much of it often, this is not always going to be true. I don't want to overgeneralize. But a lot of the time, most of what gets played is not even the melody of the standard.
Yes.
You have the chord changes just because you need some chord changes to guide your solo. But a lot of it is just people taking solos.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a lot easier to view that as its own distinct experience. Whereas, you know, again, to use Enter Sandman, right? I'm not misremembering. There's a solo in Enter. I'm sure there is. If there's not a solo, let me know in the comments below.
Yeah, there is a solo. I'm playing it in my head now.
Cool. Okay. I was pretty sure.
I think it's a solo that's mostly just it plays on the melody line a lot.
That aside, there is a solo to it, but so little. The song has such a specific structure, whereas a lot of jazz standards will have this, you know, 32 bar repeating form that makes it so that, you know, you can loop that as many times as you want in a way that you can do with Enter Sandman. You can do verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus forever. But then you have the bridge. It has a much more clearly mapped out structure.
Well, and I would say it's not just, we're talking a lot about jazz standards here. I do want to also point out that what you said about those jazz standard forms is true about a lot of other genres that use standards too, right?
Blitzkrieg Bop is a repeating pattern.
Yes.
It even repeats the lyrics.
Yeah. And like the 12 bar blues is that.
Yeah.
And that's used in blues, but also like a lot of country music will also use 12 bar blues in its stuff. Yeah. So like I want to make clear to listeners that like jazz is the genre that is, you know, probably has the richest tradition of standards with the Great American Songbook. There's a lot of different standard traditions out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like a lot of traditions are very built on repeating musical forms. Like a lot of like, at least like European folk traditions. I think also non-European folk traditions, but I am much less qualified to speak on that. So I don't want to overgeneralize again. But I know like, for instance, John Barleycorn off the top of my head, that's a repeating pattern. Basically, they're the same AABA, slightly different structure to it than a jazz standards AABA, but it's the same deal. And that is very much in a lot of these things because a lot of it comes from this idea of like, you know, the traveling bard or whatever, but the musician just sort of setting up with their acoustic guitar or whatever their instrument is and just like going at it, and having a looping form lets them go at it for as long as the audience is reacting. And as long as everyone's happy, and as long as they have more words to sing, you can just ad lib a new verse. You can ad lib whatever you want. And so having those repeating forms is really useful in a lot of ways, but it also very much lends itself to standardization.
Yeah. And like, you'll often see, like, it's pretty common to have sort of like folk jam nights at places or jams and open mic nights and stuff like that. And they're all exactly that. Like, it's, you've got a loop that people can drop into and drop out of. And, you know, when I was playing music a lot more, like in high school, me and my buddies used to find songs to jam on. And often it was like one that was one of our favorite jams was Ted Nugent's Stranglehold, which is by no means a standard, but it's operating in the 12 bar blues form. And that just makes it so much fun to jam on.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, the 12 bar blues is a standard.
Yes, exactly.
It is a skeleton that you can do whatever you, and like actual traditional blues, it was often a lot more complicated than that in terms of specifically what they played and the structures of it. It wasn't all 12 bar stuff.
Yes.
That's, I think, worth recognizing. But like the idea of the 12 bar blues is just a thing you can call. Like you can show up and be like, we're just going to jam on a blues.
Yeah. We're just going to do a blues in G. Like, yeah.
No, you have that. And it's also like frees you up from even the need to consider a specific melody, because you just have these changes and you can do whatever you want over them.
Yeah. I think to get back to sort of standards a little bit, I mean, this is all on standards, but
yeah, well, it's on Nebula now, but
I was waiting for that. That would,
yeah. wonder how many listeners will get that, but
that's definitely a deep cut.
Yeah.
I think again, like, What it all really speaks to is a tradition that believed more in collective ownership of music. This might be a shock if you've listened to an episode or two of Ghost Notes, but that's something that I really value in music.
Yeah.
Specifically, like, I think that it allows for a different kind of creativity. Generally, if you want to like do a more or less creativity thing, generally I would say like singer-songwriter traditions and sort of, you know, like structural pop traditions like we have kind of post-60s, you know, more, they do more creative things, but there is a specific sort of creativity and a specific sort of dialogue that happens when you're working within a culture of standards wherein people are conversing and building upon ideas, but also, you know, the famous idiom, like, limitations allow for creativity, and creating within the limits of, you know, these standards are they're more rigid than like open improvisation, you know, and they allow you to create within those bounds in a really compelling way.
Yeah. Like, to draw an analogy that may or may not make sense outside of my head, but it's Ghost Notes, so deal with it. But in writing, there's a lot of acknowledgement that writing and editing are different skills.
Yes.
Like, they both involve deciding which words are on a page, but they are just fundamentally different actions, and different people are good at different ones, and doing, even if you are going to do both, you sort of have to do them separately and think about them separately. And in the same way, sort of creation and interpretation in music are very different skills.
Yes.
And taking, you know, My Funny Valentine and deciding what you're going to do with it and what you have to say with those, the pieces that are there, is just such a different action than sitting down with a blank slate and creating a song with all of the pieces up to you, that I don't even know that it makes sense to compare them. Like, I don't even know that it's like that I would say one is more creative than the other,
yeah.
Which you didn't really say either, to be fair. But like, I think that it's almost the wrong question to ask, like, which of these is a more creative act, because
yeah.
They're both creative acts in such different ways.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think it's one of the things that is kind of building on what you're saying there. Like, one of the things that I think is a shame about the, you know, I'll just say reduced prevalence of standards, because I don't think they're
sure.
gone. But one of the things that standards really allow for is they really allow people who are incredibly talented interpreters to shine, you know? And
yeah.
Often that means like maybe like the greatest interpreter of the Great American Songbook is Frank Sinatra. And he is, you know, his career renaissance that came his capital years in the 50s was really just like him creating like some of the most definitive interpretations of Great American Songbook stuff that had already existed for, you know, a couple decades by then. But he just had such a rich, rich understanding of what these songs meant within, you know, a musical context, but also within a context of American culture and his moment in history. And by interpreting all of those, he was able to really say so much. And, you know, I wonder, like, I don't know that somebody who was that talented at interpreting, but didn't have, you know, as much of a tilt for like arranging and songwriting and stuff like that. Like Nelson Riddle did most of his arrangements. I mean, he helped yeah. with them. Obviously it was a collaborative thing, but I don't know if someone like Frank Sinatra, who in my mind is one of the most talented musicians ever, could exist in the modern music climate, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to throw this out there. I don't know if it's right, but it feels true to me in this exact moment. Johnny Cash made Hurt a standard.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, not many people have picked up on it yet in terms of, like, taking it and playing with it. But what he did didn't feel like it was in conversation with specifically the Nine Inch Nails version in the way that a lot of covers do. It felt like it was very much in conversation with the basic structure of the music and then his life experience. And I think that that's a lot of what that process is.
That's kind of like explicitly the goal of that whole project, right? Like
yeah.
his American songs, or what's it called? His American recordings. Because what it
yeah.
Is like it's him doing a bunch of, you know, sort of like standards, but then also incorporating, you know, other pop artists into that. You know, he covers Personal Jesus as well. And yeah, I think that that's a really good example for, you know, sort of what a modern iteration of somebody treating a pop song as a standard is. And again, pop song
yeah.
used in the loose definition
yeah.
of the word, because I wouldn't
lower
exactly.
Case B.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that also you look at, because so much of the Nine Inch Nails version is studio decisions.
Yes.
And so much of Johnny Cash's version was just looking directly into the camera and saying, I don't care one bit about any of these studio decisions.
Yeah. I think there's also just a general kind of like gravitas with which Cash approaches
yeah.
that song. All of these are reasons why it's a great cover as well. But like it does seem like he's engaging with it as part of part of a broad tradition of American songwriting.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And I like, part of me though does look at that in sort of through the lens of what you've been saying as like, it sort of had to be a Johnny Cash, right?
Yes.
Like it couldn't have been some modern country singer that no one had heard of.
Yeah.
It had to be like similar to like, you know, Frank Sinatra having his comeback by, you know, making some really great music and making some really interesting decisions, but also just being Frank Sinatra.
Yes. Yeah.
And in that same sort of way, I look at this as like Johnny Cash can declare that these are standards because he's Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
But if it was someone who I didn't have that association with yet, who I wasn't as familiar with, who was sort of new on the scene, I don't know that their version of Hurt wouldn't have read to me as just a cover.
That's a really good point. Yeah. I don't know if there's any sort of thing that can be done about that, you know, short of just opening up the cultural conversation to the existence of standards more. But I don't really know, like, I don't know really how that happens, you know?
Yeah. I mean, part of it also, and this is touching on a slightly complicated topic that we already have a whole episode about, but copyright.
Yes.
Like a lot of that is, it's much harder to do, especially because like compulsory licenses don't really give you that much freedom in terms of changes that you can make.
Yeah.
For anyone listening who doesn't know, a compulsory license is a thing that like by law, if you want to cover a song, you can, there's a certain price that you can pay that gives you the right to do a cover. But there are also, like I said, a lot of limitations on how different that cover can be, how much you can change without artistic permission from the artist before it becomes a transformative work as opposed to just a cover. And at that point, things get more complicated. And so in that sense, that structure also limits the capacity for something to become a standard because there's just a financial incentive to not treat them as one. And again, someone like Johnny Cash, in addition to having the gravitas as an artist, also just has a lot of money behind him.
Yeah.
Like there are people who, like record labels, who will look at him and be like, if we publish a Johnny Cash record, we will make a lot of money from it. So we're willing to pay to let him do whatever he wants, which I don't know that, like, because I know he did get permission, like, personally from Trent Reznor.
Yeah.
I don't know what actually went down in terms of money changing hands. I assume someone had to pay someone because labels were involved, but I just don't know. But like that sort of thing is something you can do when you're a Johnny Cash and you have that level of confidence from record labels behind you. But again, as a new artist, as someone without like that established pedigree and someone without a lot of your own personal money, like if you're not like wildly independently wealthy, it's much harder to go into these things and make the changes you would have to be able to make in order to really treat something as a standard as opposed to just someone else's song that you're covering.
Well, there's an irony there that like the realities of the music industry have made it way more difficult for something to become a standard because like the original pop music industry was completely built on standards, right? It was standards that throughout the jazz age and onward, like we said, kind of up until the mid 60s, it was standards were the only way that, you know, pop music really operated, or at least the main way. And, you know, it was interesting because at that point there was a different sort of financial motivation because a lot of what happened was song publishers got a lot of the royalties, right? So people who would, you had the kind of Tin Pan Alley type song factories that, you know, you'd have song publishers putting these out and song pluggers kind of trying to convince as many artists as possible to do it so that there would be more versions of the song out there and the song publisher would get more money from it. So it's an interesting thing that, especially me being me, there's sort of like a temptation to be like, oh, you know, the way the music industry is run now, you know, has killed the tradition of the standard, when it's like, no, the old standard traditions are just as born out of a music industry, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, like said it a million times, but art responds to culture.
Yeah.
And the specifics of the music industry in any given moment are a part of that culture. And like, and again, I do think it is fair to say that a lot of the decline, not the death again, but the decline of standards has a lot to do with changes in the music industry.
Yeah.
More than it necessarily has to do with changes in, you know, the innate spirit of art or anything.
Yeah.
Like, I think that trying to trace it without engaging with those is probably missing a bit of the point. But it's also like a thing that I want to just stress that I think I probably did already, but I'm gonna, because I don't remember doing it, is that, like, you know, standards are nice, but they're not like an essential component of a musical tradition. Like they're an essential component of some musical traditions, but like you can have a good and flourishing and vibrant musical culture and musical scenes without them.
Yes.
Like they are a thing that is cool, and it would be nice if there were more of them. But I think that especially when sort of roping in the question of like what happened, the involvement of the music industry and like how that shaped things in many ways for the worse, it's, I think, very easy to sort of overcorrect and be like, no, the fact that this is gone means that music is bad now.
Yeah.
With standards and with so many other things. And with like, and like I said, I think people are still making great art without standards, but people made a lot of great art with standards as well.
Yeah.
And it's a cool way of doing art.
I think one of my big sort of like, yeah, one of my big philosophical takes on this is it's like any sort of cultural tradition where I generally just believe that, you know, the artistic world is a richer, more vibrant place for everyone when there are more active cultural traditions to engage with, right? Like that's...
Yeah, when there are more options.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, like in a same way that, in a very similar way to like, I think the music world is better when, or you know, was better in the golden age of sampling when, you know, the sample was, and sampling is still an option, but it's not like it used to be, you know, like no. I think standards are like that, where it is a grand musical tradition that, you know, created a lot of great music and does still create a lot of great music to this day. But I just, yeah, I like drawing attention to it because I think more people should engage with that tradition just because it makes a more vibrant musical world.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you there. Like, this is definitely, I would be really interested to see some of the, you know, stylistic traditions that I tend to listen to more, like, you know, rock and metal and pop, like, develop some sense of a standard in a way that, like, was true to those genres. Because I think a lot of this, again, comes back to, like, the idea of a standard fits so well with the artistic and cultural ideals of jazz, of folk, of the blues, in ways that it sort of, the idea of like the structure of a jazz standard, the way specifically that jazz treats standards, doesn't make sense to me in metal. Like, I don't think you can do that. But that doesn't mean that metal couldn't develop its own vocabulary of standards in a way that, again, was distinct from just a vocabulary of covers and do something interesting with that. And I don't know what that would look like exactly, but I know that there are a lot of very creative and artistically talented metalheads and metal musicians. And I think that if that were a question that they were pursuing, you could find some really cool answers.
Yeah.
And so I would love to see more traditions feel comfortable to explore this. Again, not necessarily in the way that it has been historically done in the styles that it's most famous in, but again, in ways that feel authentic to those styles. Like, again, looking at Hurt, I don't think Johnny Cash's Hurt in any way resembles treating it like a jazz standard.
No. Yeah, it does resemble treating it like a country standard, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so there's that sort of that different vocabulary of standards in different cultures and what that means in a way that, like I said, I think would be cool if more cultures were exploring without, again, like, and I don't want to imply that, like, the cultures that exist are poorer for not doing it. Like, I think that there is a lot of cool stuff in those cultures as is.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a necessary thing, but I think art is better when artists are asking interesting questions. And I think that is one interesting question that artists could ask in some styles where maybe they're not asking it.
Yeah. I think that's a really great way of putting it. Cause yeah, I think that's the big thing for me with it is very much just that, like, I think it's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking that, you know, this is true of music. This is really true of everything, but it's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking that the way the culture you are in engages with something is the default way to engage with it, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's very easy to think, oh no, like there's no cultural tradition around how I engage with music. It's just music. But you know, that's never the case. You're always participating just by virtue of engaging with music. You are participating in some form of cultural conversation, right? And you're engaging with it within a certain context, whether you want to or not. And I think it's just good to be aware of the context in which you're engaging with it. And it's also good to, you know, think of and learn about other contexts and wonder what lessons, you know, especially if you are a musician, if you are a music fan, if you are a music writer, you know, it's fun to engage with these things and wonder how their lessons can be applied to your culture, your understanding of music, these sorts of things.
And potentially your art.
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, I think also, like, looking at other traditions, other cultural contexts, but also looking at your own.
Yes.
Like, this is to sort of throw out a fancy academic word, we call this defamiliarizing, where, you know, you look at your own, the things that you are very familiar with, the things that feel very intuitive to you, and asking questions and asking, like, why is that like that? This is weird. This is actually, like, within a broader historical context, unusual. And so how did we get to this point? And, like, I don't know necessarily that, like, not having standards is historically that unusual. Like, I would have to do a much deeper dive into all sorts of histories to make that claim.
I don't feel qualified to say anything like that.
It is true that within the context of American popular music, it was a change.
Yes.
We used to have them, and now we don't. As we've been stressing, it's not that they have completely disappeared, but, like, to a large extent, to within rounding error, we don't. It's not a part of the default cultural conversation around popular music.
Yeah.
And so looking at that, recognizing that that's true and that that is, has not always been true, and, you know, not even necessarily that it's good or bad, but just, this is a peculiarity of my cultural circumstances. What's it about? And how do I feel about it? Do I think that's a good thing? Like, it's a fine thing to believe that American popular music is doing better without standards.
Yeah.
If that's your take, cool. I'm not even sure I disagree with that.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure I agree with it either. I am very wishy-washy about these sorts of things. But it's still, regardless of the answers you come up with, it's valuable to ask the question.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, is standards are a really interesting way to look at that, because they were such a huge thing in American popular music for so long. And then they just went, away.
One of the things that's interesting about looking and thinking about them as well is that, you know, even though they've gone away, the acts who were influenced by them and the acts who, you know, like, created that culture had such an influence on all of the people that ended up, you know, like, taking them away.
Yeah.
And I think I just think that's interesting.
I talked about how standards don't really fit with metal, but metal is the blues with a distorted guitar.
Yes.
Like, yeah, in a lot of ways, like you can't have metal without having had the blues. And yeah, so that tradition is still very much shaped by earlier traditions where this was a more comfortable fit. And I think, you know, more mainstream pop music was also very much shaped, I mean, famously by the rock and roll era of the 50s.
Yeah.
Where a lot of that was still standards.
Yeah.
Like Elvis famously wrote like one song in his entire career.
Yeah.
And like all of these things have cultural echoes, and that doesn't make them good or bad. It just, it means that they are in some way still there. And, you know, it's interesting to ask questions about why and how.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that that's as good a place as any to leave it, unless there's anything sort of really big that you want to get in here other than standards are bad, music is bad, stop listening to music.
Yeah. I mean, music. Yeah. Yeah. Stop listening to music. Humanity was never meant to hear sounds. It was an evolutionary malfunction. But beyond that, I think, yeah, music is good and you should listen to music. So I contain multitudes.
Yeah. Check out some standards. Make some standards of your own. And please figure out what metal standards look like, because I want to hear them.
Let me know.
That would be swell.
Yeah. Gee willikers.
All right. Well, thanks so much for listening. Bye.
Goodbye.